This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Something we've heard from a lot of teachers this summer is that they're worried about the kids whose families are dealing with some serious stuff at home right now. Some have parents who are out of a job. Some were homeless before the pandemic. And others have been tipped over the brink by economic conditions in this moment. Michigan has the sixth highest rate of homeless students in the country. And many of those young people depend on the consistency of in-person teaching. As we've heard, that is definitely an unknown quantity for this fall. Jennifer Erb Downward studies homelessness at the Center for Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan, and she joins us now. Jennifer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
What does student homelessness look like in the state of Michigan? Do you tend to think about it in terms of periodic episodes for kids whose families are on the low end of the economic ladder, or more in terms of chronic conditions that may last all the way through some kids' academic careers?
You know, I think that we see both, really, but I feel like where we really need to start with this conversation is thinking about how widely spread homelessness is and widely experienced homelessness is for children in the state of Michigan. So while there's a lot of agreement that the economic impact that COVID-19 has had on the state, that we'll see an increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness, what I think not many people know about is the fact that one out of every 12 students among Michigan's fifth graders experienced homelessness at some point during elementary school. So we really have a lot of children in the state of Michigan who are living on this edge, and some of them are experiencing homelessness over multiple years. Some of them are experiencing homelessness episodically. For some students, it's a one-time experience, but really one out of every 12 students on average in the state of Michigan are experiencing homelessness at some point during elementary school. And that's really a lot of students.
If there were no COVID this year, what would we be talking about with respect to the accommodations that students who are living with housing insecurity, that what accommodations they need in their school days?
The first thing is, when we think about accommodations for homeless students, what do you think we really want to be thinking about is rights that homeless students have? Because fundamentally, homeless students have a right to the same education that their peers have. And the idea behind McKinney-Vento law is that you don't want to see housing instability and homelessness taking away that fundamental right of an education for children.
Can you explain the law for the layperson?
Sure. So the law basically defines homelessness for children as any student who is lacking a fixed, regular, adequate nighttime residence. So they really don't have a stable place where they're living. And so some things that the law has done to provide supports and to help students have access to the education that they have a right to is, one, a right to immediate enrollment in school. So any parent who has ever enrolled their child in school knows that, you know, you show up, you have to provide certain documents, a proof of address, birth certificate, vaccination records. So one thing for families who are experiencing homelessness is that there will be a right to immediate enrollment. So they show up, their child is immediately enrolled, and then they have a period of time to gather those documents. Another right that's really critical is a right to transportation. So often when you're experiencing housing instability, you might end up living in a location that is far away from your child's original school. And so a child has a right to stay in that school and then also be provided with transportation support. And then on top of those rights, children also have the same right to access in terms of participation after school programs, you know, assistance with basic needs like school supplies, backpacks, you know, participation in maybe school field trips or access to a yearbook, things along those lines. So those are really the key elements that are part of the law.
Schools are dealing with a lot right now. Are they able to provide these kinds of accommodations in this moment?
So I think that's a great question. Federally, they are mandated to provide these accommodations, to provide these supports. One thing I think we're really thinking about, though, is if schools go remote, how do we identify students who are experiencing housing instability and homelessness? And that's a really critical piece. Another element that we need to think about here is just some of the very basic needs. Schools are where many children receive their meals, sometimes breakfast, lunch, and even dinner. And if schools are not open, how are we getting those supplies? How are we getting those resources to kids? You know, another example I think can be is as we think about remote learning, because many schools are looking into this.
Well, I did want to ask you about that, actually. We've talked to an awful lot of educators who are increasingly feeling like, even if their district has not come out and said it already, that a significant portion of the year is going to be conducted online. What accommodations can schools make for homeless students if a district is only doing online teaching?
Well, the first thing is that they need to figure out how to provide that student with the resources they need to participate in online learning. So a laptop, access to Wi-Fi. And one element to that, Detroit Public Schools is actually participating with the Detroit City on a very interesting effort to reduce the digital divide and promote digital equity. What they've done as a part of this is that they've tied the Wi-Fi to the laptop. You know, if you're thinking about how do you address the digital divide for many people, often you might tie that to a house. But I think when we're talking about homelessness and housing instability and thinking about what the needs are of children who are highly mobile, we need to be making sure that if we're talking about remote learning, if we're talking about providing Wi-Fi and laptops, that that Wi-Fi is something that moves with the laptop, that moves with the child.
Jennifer, no doubt there are a million ways in which students and families find ways to cover when they're in between apartments, when they're crashing with relatives or sleeping in their car. Can we assume that COVID makes it more difficult to keep people from knowing what's going on with them?
I mean, I think there are a number of different ways that I think it's going to make it more difficult for people to know what's going on with them. You know, if we're looking at the remote environment, there is not necessarily going to be in-person enrollment that where you would have that opportunity to talk to a family and identify that they might be struggling. For many families, one of the reasons why childhood homelessness and family homelessness is so invisible in terms of when we think about what homelessness looks like societally is because so many families will just double up with another family temporarily or couch surf or live in their car. One thing that the pandemic will really impact in that way, not as many people are going to feel comfortable taking someone in. For families that do end up staying with other families, they're then living in an overcrowded situation, and both families are going to be at greater risk in terms of COVID. So there are real issues of overcrowding, the impact that that might have on people's health. If someone gets sick, will they be able to stay there? Will they get kicked out? Where will they be able to recover? So there's just so many different issues that are wrapped up, I think, in what's going on now. And all of the challenges that we see people struggling with, they're just magnified when we think about not having the stability of a place that you live, that you know you can be, that you know you can recover, where you know your child will be safe.
Do you worry about the students who may be living on the street and just spending, having that same worry that so many parents have about their kids now, that they're just spending more time unsupervised?
So for children who are unaccompanied and homeless youth, this is a group that really is at the greatest risk. And I think that is actually acutely true for Michigan because of a number of laws that the state has. And I'm just going to mention those really quickly, and then I'll, you know, go back to some of the risks that these youth face. But in the state of Michigan, minors are not allowed to consent for their own health care. So if you have an unaccompanied minor who's experiencing homelessness on the street, maybe they're couch surfing, if they get sick, they don't have the ability to go and seek medical care and consent for medical care on their own. This means that they would have to be in a state of life-threatening emergency for them to be receiving care. That is exactly what we don't want to see in the context of a pandemic. We also see that access to shelter for youth who are minors and unaccompanied is really limited because there is a licensing law in the state of Michigan that requires that there's parental consent within 24 hours of an unaccompanied minor seeking shelter. And, you know, because for minors, when they are running away from home, this is most often a crisis of relationship, right? So you need time to establish safety. You need time to establish what is the story of what's happened. How can you best help that child? And 24 hours is not sufficient. With these regulations or policies that have existed prior to COVID again, what is missing now is that youth also don't have access to schools. They don't have access to drop-in centers, to libraries, all of the places where there may have been adults that were helping in some way to provide a point of connection, to provide support and resources. They are missing right now. But we need to figure out how can we reach youth who don't have adults who are able to support them, who don't have access to any of these services right now. And then just really thinking about how our current laws that existed before the pandemic are even more adversely affecting these youth now. It's placing them at greater risk for human trafficking. We know that mental health, depression, suicidality among unaccompanied youth and homeless youth, it's higher than the general population of youth overall. This is going to again be exacerbated in the current crisis, particularly when people don't have networks of support or these networks of support have been broken.
Within the past few days, the governor's moratorium on evictions came to an end. And I was wondering how you see that affecting the school year and all of these needs for all these kids.
Yeah, so that is, you know, that is a really big issue. I think all of us are waiting to see what happens moving forward with bills passed around unemployment insurance, to see whether that continues. There are a lot of families who are at risk of facing eviction. One thing I think that it's important for everyone to know about from a prevention standpoint is that the state of Michigan's allocated $50 million to rental assistance through their eviction prevention program. And so anyone or any family who has received a notice to quit from their landlord or a summons from the court, and if they have less income than the area median income, they're eligible for these funds. So one thing that I would strongly advocate is for, you know, all school districts, as they are working to enroll students, whether they're going remotely or in person, that this information is shared with families, because there are going to be so many more families who are at risk of losing their home. And the educational consequences, the health consequences of not having a stable place to live for a child are huge.
You mentioned that the state is making some cash assistance available for housing costs. Are there other resources available for the families that are in an insecure position right now?
The other resource that I think it would be incredibly helpful, again, for schools, social service agencies, any group that is in connection with families, particularly as schools are starting to roll out their plan, is the federal stimulus. There are a lot of families who are eligible for this who have not yet received federal stimulus. And many of those families are going to be the families who are at most risk. So families who earn less than $24,000 a year are not required to file taxes. This means that if they've never filed taxes, they will not automatically be getting that benefit.
Or it may be they don't have a bank account and no place to report in to get the deposit sent.
That is another very large issue, but there are ways around that. So if a family doesn't have a bank account, a community organization can work with them. You can link an EBT card to that. There are actually a number of resources that are highlighted on Poverty Solutions' website that provide instructions for all the different ways that you can go about trying to apply for the stimulus, to access stimulus, what to do if you don't have a bank account. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of families who are experiencing housing instability right now likely have not received that benefit. And that is money that could be a huge help, particularly in the context of the pandemic right now and the instability that people are experiencing. So again, spreading that information widely with families is really important right now. And I think there's an opportunity to do that in the context of enrollment. How do we make sure that as we are rolling out school, which I know is incredibly complicated right now, but we need to be thinking about how we meet the basic needs of families as well.
If a family is dealing with housing insecurity, you know, where does where does COVID fall in terms of, you know, the worries that they have to deal with on a 24/7 basis? I imagine that it might seem like a different priority compared to where is my family going to sleep tonight?
I definitely think the number one priority for people is always going to be, where am I going to sleep tonight? You know, where am I going to get food? Then from there, I think it's probably going to depend on their experience. I mean, if you look at people who know other families, other people who have died of COVID, I'm sure are much more frightened, are taking that much more seriously, are prioritizing it because it does seem like a life and death situation. I think there's always a hierarchy of needs. You deal with first what you have to deal with, right? And shelter and food are always going to be sort of the top among that. But I still think that there's going to be a wide range of how people are thinking about prevention, or whether or not they feel like they have the option to think about prevention. And I think that might depend a lot on where they are, and what they're seeing around them, and what the social norms around them are, how many people they've seen impacted. I mean, at first people said, you know, coronavirus was going to be the great equalizer, right? But what we see is it's far from being an equalizer. We see huge disparities among races and economics. And I think that will impact also how people respond to prevention. What is their experience? What have they seen around them? You know, I spoke with a woman not so long ago in Detroit who told me that she knew, you know, 5 different people who had died. You know, that I think places you in a very different mindset than if you don't know anyone. I think it's going to be mixed.
Jennifer Erb Downward is a senior research associate at the University of Michigan Center for Poverty Solutions. Jennifer, thanks for talking us through some of this.
Well, thank you so much for having me.